KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Welcome to Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. Immigration agents are apprehending migrants at immigration hearings, at their children's schools, at their places of employment, or while walking on the street. Some of those deported have visas. Many have no criminal records. Advocacy groups like the International Mayan League also say indigenous migrants have to contend with confusing changes in policy on top of language barriers. We'll find out from those on the ground about the current push for mass deportation right after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Pell Grants send thousands of lower-income students to college each year across the country. However, proposed changes could lower that number drastically, often in the communities that need it most, like tribes. South Dakota Public Broadcasting CJ Keene has more.
Proposed Trump administration changes could slash Pell Grant funding by as much as a quarter. In a tribal setting like the Pine Ridge Reservation, that represents well over 60% of students reliant on some amount of Pell Grant support. Oglala Lakota College President Don Frank says that would devastate tribal colleges and their students across America.
These proposed changes are extremely concerning because raising the full-time credit requirements and excluding less than part-time students would disproportionately harm TCUs. Part-time TCU power recipients see substantial increases in certificate and degree completion rates, and that's something that we're looking at that is across the board for TCUs.
Frank says TCUs offer nearly a $90 million economic impact to South Dakota alone when accounting for jobs, workforce development, and education. While contingencies do exist at Oglala Lakota College, Frank is concerned about the worst coming to pass with an associated loss of students.
Losing that would mean that everyone would have to take a step back. If we're not producing graduates to work in those positions, then I could see a lot of hardship to look at, coupling it with the financial necessity amid the rising inflation of an affordable child care. Transportation, especially in our rural areas, and the strain, we know we already said that it would be almost cripple us or close us.
Frank is calling upon tribal leaders to advocate for their tribal colleges and universities to statewide D.C. delegations, and specifically asked South Dakota Representative Dusty Johnson and Senators John Thune and Mike Rounds to champion the issue. For National Native News, I'm C.J. Keene in Rapid City.
President Trump recently instructed the Interior Department to look into erasing negative references to the nation's past while embracing the beauty, abundance, and grandeur of the American landscape. But as KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports, a Native group worries history will be erased.
Trump's executive order, which covers 500 million acres of federal land, is titled Restoring Truth and Sanity to American History.
From a tribal perspective, could say, great, we're overdue for a little truth and sanity in American history, but of course we mean the opposite.
Valerie Grusing runs the nonprofit National Association of Tribal Historic Preservation Officers. The government is reviewing monuments and other markers that have been removed, renamed, or altered since 2020 for what it calls a false reconstruction of American history. But Grusing worries this mandate simply means whitewashing the past. The federal agency says the order isn't about erasing history, but meant to free narratives from ideological distortion. Any content deemed inappropriate shall be removed within 120 days. Gabriel Pietrazio, Phoenix.
The leader of the Cherokee Nation in Oklahoma is expressing his concern over the closure of Job Corps training centers across the country. The Cherokee Nation says it was the first tribe to operate a Job Corps in 1978, and the program currently serves around 150 students. The federal government recently announced it was pausing the Job Corps program, which helps people ages 16 through 24 with career training. In a video message on social media this week, Principal Chief Chuck Hoskin Jr. shared an update saying the pause is an outright termination of the program. adding he opposes the closure and says the tribe is working to save the program.
Job Corps is often a career lifeline to students who may be struggling to find a path.
The tribe is suspending its Job Corps operations and preparing to send residential students home on June 13th. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by Arctic Encounter 2025, an Arctic policy and business convening July 30th to August 1st that explores community resilience, critical infrastructure, and traditional knowledge. Early bird registration through June 15th at arcticencounter.com.
Support for law and justice-related programming provided by Hobbs Strauss Dean & Walker, LLP, a national law firm dedicated to promoting and defending tribal rights for over 40 years. More information available at HobbsStrauss.com.
Support by Siri, with a diverse and strategic investment portfolio for the long-term benefit of their shareholders. Investing in energy, infrastructure, real estate, government services, and more. Information is available at CIRI.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. Even with a highly publicized increase in arrests and deportations, White House officials are pushing to ramp up deportations of what they say are unauthorized immigrants. NBC News reports White House Deputy Chief of Staff Stephen Miller threatens to fire immigration officials and field offices with monthly arrest numbers in the bottom 10%. The constant pressure and the push for mass deportations is instilling fear among people here from other countries. And current policies are cutting off any path for legal residency for undocumented indigenous people fleeing violence in countries like Guatemala, Honduras, and Colombia. Today we're going to hear from people working to help migrants in the fast-moving legal environment. You can join us too. Do you interact frequently with immigrants where you live? If so, what do they tell you about their concerns over deportation? Give us a call. We're at 1-800-996-2848. That number again, 1-800-996-2848, or just 1-800-99-NATIVE. We've got the phone lines open now. Joining us is Juanita. She's part of the Mayan League, and she's a member of the MAM Nation. Hello, Juanita, and welcome to Native America Calling.
Hello, good afternoon. I send good greetings to all the listeners from Piscataway Nation Territory, and I just want to thank you for having us again on the show and for opening the space to share our perspectives, our concerns, and also ways that we are building solidarity and solutions in our community and with allies.
Thank you, Juanita, very much. We're also joined by Nola. She's a Maya, Quechi, and Spanish interpreter, and she is Quechi. Nola, hello to you as well, and welcome to our show.
Hello, thank you for having me here. I am Nola from Koban Alta Verapaz. I speak Quechi, and I am an interpreter in the Quechi, Spanish and English languages.
Thank you so much, Nola, and Juanita, too. And Juanita, I want to begin with you. Let's talk about the New York Times. It tracks deportation destinations, and most deportation flights go to Guatemala. Can you give us an idea as to why that is?
Well, first of all, thank you so much for giving us this space to discuss this really critical moment for so many of our communities. For those who may not be familiar, Guatemala is an indigenous majority country that in the past several years has been consistently one of the highest in terms of immigration trends. And much of this in terms of forced migration, forced displacement of indigenous peoples, not just from Guatemala, but that it tends to be one of the higher countries in terms of data, is really because of more than 500 years of colonization, forced displacement, and genocide of indigenous peoples. And then the last, in my lifetime, genocide of indigenous peoples. And so we look at the effects of war, displacement, lack of land titles, and all of these have made conditions that are inhabitable for many people. And so we look at immigration trends or forced immigration trends, we see that many people have come to the United States from Guatemala and are a majority indigenous group, even though official data has not recognized our indigeneity. And that is one of the key problems. So when we look at now at this ramp up of criminalization and dehumanization of migrants in general, and really the racialization of our peoples, regardless of whether we're indigenous or not, but really looking at our skin color, at what languages we speak, we see that indigenous peoples in migration, whether they're from Guatemala or another country, tend to be more vulnerable because of the language barrier, because of the particular cultural and experiences that we come from. And therefore, we may not be able to quickly say, for instance, that we have a credible fear because we can't actually communicate anything. And right now, at this point, as was mentioned, the quota is so high that due process has been thrown out the window. And those who are most vulnerable are those who are not able to speak and defend themselves and express their human rights. And that includes indigenous peoples. And then within those categories, women, children, and of course, as we've also seen a ramp up in the LGBTQ2S+ community with the multiple intersection of identities.
All right. I want to share some information right now with our listeners. We're only using Juanita and Nola's first names to protect their identities because they've experienced harassment related to the work that they do. Juanita, going back to Guatemala, do you know if most of the people who are deported to that country are undocumented?
You know, at this point, because there has, again, going back to the disaggregated data and the lack thereof, many people who are coming here, even if they're showing up in asylum claims and in different tracking, such as thematic hearings, it doesn't necessarily specify their indigeneity. And then when we've been working with communities, we never ask somebody's status. Again, looking at the trends of who's being forced to come here, there are many people who, if we look at some of the trends in denial of asylum cases, for instance, many of the people who actually probably had an asylum case were not able to adequately express their case because they didn't have an interpreter and they didn't speak Spanish or English enough to present their case. Therefore, many people have fallen through the cracks because they weren't able to adequately present and defend their case. And my colleague Nola can speak more on that as an interpreter. I will just add quickly that one of the things we're still seeing in Guatemala and in other countries in Central and South America is ongoing land conflicts. Because this has not been adequately addressed, today we're still seeing large-scale forced evictions, particularly in Guatemala right now, the Maya Kekchi Nation. And we've also seen an uptick of people being forced to come here from the Maya Kekchi Nation. But if you look at some of the data in terms of denial of asylum claims, it actually has been some of the data that we have found has been Maya Kekchi. And in theory, they should be able to present a very strong asylum claim, but many of them were likely not afforded a lawyer, an interpreter who could help defend their rights, communicating their story.
Okay. Now, you mentioned earlier that you don't ask for the status of the people that you work with, and I think some of our listeners might want to know why that is.
You know, there is so much fear right now in our community simply because of who we are. And in the case of indigenous peoples who have been subjected to extreme racism and discrimination for more than 500 years, and in the most extreme case, persecuted simply for being indigenous, there's also a huge lack of trust. And so when we work with our community, we're working from a place of humanity, of dignity, and that does not stop, that does not start or stop with someone's status. We're all human beings, and that's how we do our work in terms of understanding that we have a shared humanity and that our services, our human rights are afforded regardless of status. We still have the right to an interpreter. We still have the right to be free of discrimination, again, regardless of status.
Okay. And this rush to deport people out of the United States, how is this affecting migrant communities and the people that you work with? What are some of the stories that you hear and some of the experiences that are shared?
You know, it has been a very, very destabilizing and extremely scary time for our community. Everyday life is being disrupted. We have had stories told of people simply going to, for instance, 7-Eleven to go get a coffee, and they're apprehended and in a matter of hours deported. Doing simple daily tasks like taking your children to school, going to a place of worship. We've heard multiple of those stories of having that fear of perhaps not coming home. There's increased bullying in the schools because children are being, again, singled out because of their skin color, because of the languages that they speak. And so there's re-triggering of trauma, especially for many of the families that are in our communities who have been forced to flee violence, genocide, human rights violations, and now seeing that there's no safety for them. And most recently, I think people are making the decision of, quote, self-deportation. But really, the conditions in which they are living in their communities has made it so that there's no safety, there's no security. And they rather make this decision. Again, I'm using that word lightly because it really hasn't, it's forced on them. And so I think for Indigenous peoples, when we look at being forced to migrate and conditions often around human rights violations, they're being forced to leave their ancestral lands, like from Guatemala. And now, again, we're seeing our communities targeted and being forced to leave. And so one of the things I really want to stress is that for Indigenous peoples, many of our elders say we are a people without a state. And I think the conditions that we are seeing right now, the dehumanization of who we are, really shows that.
All right, we're going to take a short break. We're going to come back and continue our conversation. And we do have the phone lines open for listeners who would like to join our conversation today here on Native America Calling. Just pick up your phone and call 1-800-996-2848. 1-800-996-2848. We're waiting for your call. After three decades and 7,500 hour-long episodes, Native America Calling is still the only national live call-in radio show dedicated to Indigenous issues from Indigenous perspectives. That doesn't happen without generations of dedicated Native producers and hosts. We're celebrating 30 years on the air on the next Native America Calling.
Support provided by Amerind. Amerind is 100% tribally owned and partners with tribes and their businesses to provide affordable commercial insurance coverage, protect tribal sovereignty, and strengthen Native American communities by helping to keep dollars in Indian country. Information about property, liability, commercial auto, and workers' comp available at Amerind.com. That's Amerind.com.
You are listening to Native America Calling. We're hearing about the experiences of migrants today. How is your tribe responding to President Trump's directives to rush deportation of who it says are unauthorized migrants? You can give us a call and join our conversation. The number is 1-800-996-2848. We've got the phone lines open now. Give us a call. Share your thoughts. Share your insights. Share your perspectives. 1-800-996-2848. Let's hear now from Nola. She is a Maya Quechi and Spanish interpreter. And Nola, tell us about the work that you do with migrants, and also how are you linked to people who need your services?
Thank you. I am linked to services by organizations such as the Mayan League, who is well known, and people reach out to them. Other courts have my name, and organizations such as the NAJIT, who are the National Association for Judicial Interpreters, have my name, and I have been interpreting since 2002. And in the Mayan language, I have been interpreting since 2008. So people know me, and they provide my name to people who need my services.
Now, do you accompany people to hearings? Do you go and represent them in meetings? I'm curious to know a little bit more about how you actually assist people.
The way I have been doing it this lately, since the pandemic, I have been doing it online, and most of the interpretations we do are for hearings, for DUIs, for asylum seekers. Offices, legal offices call me, and we do it by Zoom. In very delicate criminal cases, I am requested to go in person. I go to different states.
Different states. And what are you seeing with the people that you work with and accompanying them, working with them online? What are the concerns that they share with you? And even if you can, just share some of the details of some of these proceedings that you assist with.
I am not allowed to speak to the clients that I serve, because I serve as an interpreter. The only thing that, as an interpreter, the only thing we have to do is to be a bridge of communication, which means that it is the provider who speaks to them, and whatever the provider says, we interpret into their the indigenous language, and then English, and vice versa. So what I have noticed, however, is that people are afraid of appearing at their hearings. They are not going to the meetings for the individual IEPs, the individualized educational programs for the children, because of fear that they will be arrested.
Mm-hmm. How
the
big
no-shows have increased. I'm sorry, the no-shows have increased, and the people, the providers tell me, I'm sorry, we will call you back because the client is not here.
Okay. And how big a need is there for interpreters such as yourself? Are you able to handle all of the need, or is there still a need for more people to do the kind of work that you do?
There is a huge need for people who speak interpreters who speak a Mayan language, English, and Spanish. There is so much need to train new interpreters who speak English, because it takes longer to interpret from one language than relay interpreting into Spanish. And then if the indigenous speaker does not understand English or doesn't speak it, they need a relay interpreting from English to Spanish.
Okay, so it sounds like there could actually be multiple interpreters then involved in assisting some of these people. Is that right?
Yes. And what is very unique to indigenous languages is that they vary according to regions. In my home country, like Guatemala, we have 22 languages, and many of them have different differences according to the region where the person comes from.
All right. Thank you, Nola. Let's go to the phones. We have Autumn, who is listening to our show in Santa Fe, New Mexico on KUNM Radio. Hello, Autumn. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi, Autumn. What's your comment?
I just wanted to share some good things that happened in my community that involved with being in solidarity with Latino communities. I'm a Native woman that grew up in this town, and I'm from Taos Pueblo and Acoma Pueblo, but growing up in Santa Fe, knowing that I had a lot of friends and people in my life that were also Hispanic or Latino, and knowing and understanding, like, I guess growing up with them and then eventually learning about issues or inequalities that affected them. And I think I had a strong passion of knowing what that meant, because being an Indigenous person and growing up in Santa Fe also meant that I understood my history and, like, the inequalities we face as Native people. But anyways, I just wanted to share that last month in May, there was some good things that happened in Santa Fe as far as, like, building that community for Latino families. So sometimes I help with an organization called EarthCare, but they were able to get a mobile consulate of Guatemala to travel to Santa Fe, and they helped lots of families with just, you know, access to having services. And sometimes that also looked like just making sure that they had access to looking at consular IDs, passports, and dual citizenship application. So just kind of wanting to share that insight and knowing that, like, there are positive actions happening, but it's also a thing where we can't ignore this issue because it's very much in our face today. And knowing that as Native people, we understand the history and hardship of, like, what displacement is. And, like, a lot of these families have similar struggles, and holding compassion and understanding kind of builds that solidarity in our communities together.
All right, Autumn, really appreciate you calling in. Hey, do me a favor, post on our social media, post on Facebook, Instagram, Blue Sky Threads, some of these resources that you're familiar with, or just some of this knowledge and information. Would you do that for us? Put a post on there for us on social media? Awesome. All right. Thank you so much for calling in, Autumn. Really, really do appreciate you joining the conversation. Nola, I want to go back to you because one of the topics that really is on a lot of people's minds right now is the whole notion of U.S.-born children of migrants. Can you tell us where those people stand right now in relation to all these issues that we're dealing with now with regard to deportation?
Thank you. Yes, that is another issue that brings about so much psychological trauma in families, not only the families who are here, but the families back home, the children, the immediate families. I have heard of families who have been here for 22 years and say, every day I go to work thinking that I may not come back. And what will I do with my children? And the children, if they are returned to their homeland, there are kids who have been educated here, who know the system here. They have not, they're not familiar with their village anymore, and some other people who have sold their land, or they have been displaced because their land was acquired
they have no place to go back. And so there's no way, there are no words to describe how much this is a generational impact on children, families, and ancestors.
Nola, what about children who are separated from their families? What can you tell us about what is happening to those families in those situations?
Some children who are separated by their families have multiple ways of expressing that separation. They are failing in school. They are not happy. They would like to have their parents here because they wouldn't want to go back. They know if, depending upon their age, they know that it is not a good idea for the family to be separated, or they have no one to care for them here. Sometimes if they are minors who are in foster care because there is no other family member close by, they are not happy. They are put in places where it's very different from their family, from their upbringing, their values. Even if people where they are placed speak Spanish, it is not the same, and they are not being the confusion. Psychologically, and they don't know whether to feel happy that they are going to be here and their parents are away, or they have no way of helping the issue.
Nola and Juanita, both thank you very much for joining our conversation today. I want to bring another perspective in now. This is Danny Christney, who joins us from Phoenix, Arizona, where he is the managing attorney of Willer O'Reilly Immigration Lawyers Phoenix office. He is of Maya Kekchi descent. Danny, hi. Welcome to the conversation. So glad you can join us.
Good morning, Shanshaquil. It's a pleasure to be with everyone this morning.
Absolutely. Well, listening to Juanita and Nola share some of these experiences, some of these situations, I just want to ask you up front, what is the most recent immigration policy that people should be aware of right now?
I mean, it's something that's changing, it seems like, daily, right? With the different press conferences or even just tweets kind of announcing certain policies. But the policy is that if you are here and you don't have proof of lawful permanent residence or U.S. citizenship, it almost feels like it's fair game, because people that had previously followed every instruction of the government, whether it was scheduling an appointment for a credible fear interview while they were waiting in Mexico as they were instructed, or they were admitted to the United States and filed for asylum and are attending their hearings or attending their check-ins with their local ICE office, trying to follow every instruction and do things the right way, these people are still being apprehended and being treated as if they have no documentation. And that's kind of the message, is this blanket terminology of, you know, you shouldn't be here, and we're going to make this process as difficult for you as possible. I think that's the most consistent interpretation of all these different policies and how they're being enacted.
Mm-hmm. Danny, how about people who may have visas, or again, going back to U.S. born children, can you tell us, can they be deported or not?
So that's a very interesting question. And we have seen some examples recently of U.S. born children who have been removed with their families back to their home country. And you can't deport a U.S. citizen, but when you make it impossible for that child to remain in the United States, kind of like what Nola was saying, is you don't have someone who can care for this child, they have no option but to take the child back to their home country. So it's almost like a de facto deportation, right? Even though they're a U.S. citizen and they have every right to be here. And that's not even touching the rabbit hole of the current administration's attempt to do away with birthright citizenship in this country, right? And what the ramifications of that will be. And aside from visa holders, we're seeing a much stricter interpretation for visa holders. I know the current rhetoric is one strike and you're out, and you have situations where due to using artificial intelligence to try to comb through student visas or employment visas, sometimes you know, people are being flagged for things that we would never imagine would cause deportability, like someone who had an issue where they were fishing and they didn't have a license and they had a fine and they had their student visa revoked, things like that. So it really is just chaotic. I think that's the best way to sum it up.
There have been a couple of high-profile deportations of people who shouldn't have been deported. What rights should people be familiar with if they find themselves confronted by ICE?
Yeah, and that's an excellent question. And I think this is something that's universal, whether you are an immigrant, whether you're a member of a tribe, or whether you're just the average U.S. citizen, right, is that we're seeing increased enforcement. Not everyone is going to have proof that you're a U.S. citizen. Sometimes people don't have a passport. They don't have their driver's license on them. They don't have their birth certificate, or they lost their birth certificate. So my number one recommendation to people is to carry an ID, right? And especially for tribal members, you need to have proof of your tribal membership, your certificate of Indian blood, along with any other document that you could easily show an ICE officer proving your citizenship, because there has been instances where tribal members have been mistakenly arrested by ICE here in Arizona because they didn't have their tribal ID, or the ICE officer, because they're normally not interacting with members of the tribe, didn't believe that the document was authentic, or things of that nature. So number one is to have your identification. Number two is to request that they identify themselves. We're seeing a lot of issues of plainclothes officers, you know, waiting in the courts to detain people, or arresting people on the street when they don't have a uniform. You wouldn't ever expect this person to be law enforcement.
All right, we're going to take another break. We're going to come back. We'll continue our conversation with Danny Krisny. And we have another guest as well who's going to join us, Dr. David Martinez, a professor of American Indian Studies and Transborder Studies, and some other accomplishments as well. He's with Arizona State University. So stay with us, listeners. We'll be back in just a moment.
Trickster Cultural Center, an authentic first voice of Native American veterans and cultural arts, will host the 2025 Pride Celebration, honoring diversity through Native drum and dance, artistry, resource exchanges, and vendor fare. Trickster Cultural Center's Pride Celebration is open to everyone at no charge, June 7th from 2 to 7 p.m. in Schaumburg, Illinois. More under events at tricksterculturalcenter.org or at 847-301-2090. Trickster Cultural Center supports this show. This program is supported by AmeriCorps Vista. Through service with AmeriCorps Vista, you gain valuable professional experience and leadership skills while helping organizations in your community alleviate poverty. Find a service opportunity at AmeriCorps.gov/Vista today. That's AmeriCorps.gov/Vista.
Support by the American Indian College Fund. The American Indian College Fund provides millions of dollars of scholarships to thousands of Native students every year. Tribal citizens of every age and experience are eligible. The deadline for applications is May 31st, and you can find everything you need to apply at collegefund.org. That's collegefund.org, or by phone at 800-766-FUND. Education is the answer.
Support by Costco Business Center, offering delivery to Anchorage Air Cargo Companies for shipments to rural Alaska for business and home. More at CostcoBusinessDelivery.com. Support for this program provided by ConocoPhillips Alaska, operating in Alaska for more than 50 years and valuing the opportunity to partner with Alaska Native communities.
This is Native America Calling, and there is still time to join today's discussion about immigration. Is your tribe among those offering advice for how to deal with ICE agents? Give us a call. Tell us what you think. We're at 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And we have another caller on the line right now. This is Waylon, who's listening online in Flagstaff. Good morning, Waylon. You are on the air.
Good morning. Thank you. In 2015, my tribe, I'm Hualapai, we're in Northwest Arizona. My tribal council passed a resolution in support of immigration reform. And if I could get my hands on a resolution that for my tribal council to consider, I'm sure they would pass it, a resolution that opposes immigration raids and sweeps and deportations. It's the right thing to do, and we need to do it. As you mentioned earlier, those of us with brown skin, we could get mistaken for not being a citizen, and we could get arrested and detained. And so I think tribes need to get in the game. And this is just one issue. There's all kinds of other issues that we need to get involved in and stake out positions. Going back to this deportation issue, you know, the United States likes to brag to the world that we are a nation of laws, that the rule of law is king here in the U.S. It isn't. And lately it has not been. And all these actions by the current Trump administration prove that. It sounds good. It sounds really great, but it's not that way. And, mm-hmm. and tribes, I think, need to get in the game.
Waylon, really appreciate your call. Thank you so much. And Danny, I'd like you to respond to what Waylon says. He challenges this notion that the United States is a nation of laws. Is there any precedence for what we're seeing right now, what we're talking about today, Danny?
You know, not in recent memory, right? And half the problem is kind of this invalidation in mass of previous interpretations of the law or previous policy memos. You know, the most recent example was the enforcement priorities for ICE was people who had criminal histories or people that had been convicted of certain crimes, right? And that kind of went out the window to where now it's the most low-hanging fruit. So you have the people who are trying, again, to do the right thing by showing up to their hearings. They're showing up to their check-ins. They're filing their asylum applications. They're explaining why they're fearful of returning to their country of origin, waiting for their final hearing, and they're not being allowed to do that because of these threats of being detained or being removed or all these other consequences that come from detention. So they're going for the most low-hanging fruit, and they're actually punishing those immigrants who are abiding by all the rules, all the regulations they were instructed to when they were typically allowed to enter this country after passing a credible fear interview or being paroled into this country. So it's kind of flipping the script on its head completely. And this is what's been causing the chaos. And these are the calls I'm getting every day of, do I even go to court? Do I even go to my ICE check-in? And mm-hmm. again, these are individuals who are lucky enough to have counsel. The majority of people don't have an attorney because in immigration proceedings, you do not have a right to government counsel. You have to hire a private attorney.
Thank you, Danny. Phone lines are still open. We have time for more calls if anyone else would like to join the discussion. 1-800-996-2848. And we also have another guest to introduce now. Joining us from Tempe, Arizona is Dr. David Martinez. He is a professor of American Indian Studies and Transborder Studies and the director and founder of the Institute for Transborder Indigenous Nations at Arizona State University. He's Akamil Otham and enrolled with the Gila River Indian Community. Dr. Martinez, you've been on the show before. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me. Also, I want to acknowledge the work that your guests are doing. They're doing brave work, and I just think it's amazing.
Sure. Yeah, I think they appreciate hearing that from you. And I want to ask you as well, Dr. Martinez, to chime in on what our listener who just called into the show with regard to tribes stepping it up and getting involved. Can you tell us more about how tribes are weighing in on immigration policy? Can you give us some specific examples?
Sure. When it comes to tribes' reaction to immigration and border security, especially under the current administration, the issue has been less about the immigrants themselves and more about tribes' relationship to the Department of Homeland Security. In particular, you know, tribes have been concerned about the domination that DHS has had on Indian land, you know, for more than a generation. And so when you hear about, say, ICE agents going into reservation communities, like happened up in Navajo Nation, the reason why they're there is because, and this isn't an ideal reason, the reason why they're there is because tribal nations do not have any jurisdiction over immigration or border security. And so they're left to the discretion of CBP and ICE when it comes to addressing or responding to this problem. In which case, when it comes to regarding immigration, whether indigenous immigrants or other types of immigrants, as say a humanitarian problem, those sentiments do exist within Native communities. An example of somebody who feels that immigration is a humanitarian crisis. But when it comes to affecting tribal policy and immigration, you know, we're stuck in a bind. We're usually obliged to develop partnerships with CBP and ICE because tribal police do not have jurisdiction over immigration at all. But at the same time, when it comes to the humanitarian response, it's largely left to rank and file tribal members to address that. So there are people out, say, in Tohono O'odham Nation who well put out water and food for immigrants, but they do so at the risk of their own safety and well-being. Tribal government typically doesn't like people doing that sort of thing. And so when it comes to the issues that your other guests are raising, what is important to recognize is that when it comes to how tribal nations see cases like Mayan immigrants come up, for a lot of tribal nations, it's not that the indigeneity of these immigrants don't matter at all. They do. But most tribal nations, at the level of tribal government, are going to respond to this as largely a law and order issue. So on the one hand, for example, you have DHS circulating a guidebook on how to look for human trafficking in the hospitality industry. So a lot of casinos and resorts run by tribes. And so the response to people using these facilities, you know, for human trafficking, you know, is a tribal issue because of these casinos and resorts. At the same time, when it comes to rank and file people, the reaction has been for tribes to circulate the Know Your Rights campaign, because a primary concern for the average tribal citizen, especially who live on the reservation, is that, you know, they're going to be targeted by CBP or ICE just because they have brown faces. And even before Trump came along, there was story after story after story of tribal members being detained and even arrested by CBP. So in a nutshell, the response from the tribal community in general is a response that is conditioned by a federal agency, DHS, basically invading and occupying Indian land.
All right. I want to provide a disclaimer. We did reach out to the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, aka ICE, for a comment. We didn't hear back from them. And we also reached out to Tohono O'odham, Kokopa, and Fort Yuma Quechan tribes for comment and didn't hear back from them either by showtime. We've got another caller on the line. This is Kenneth, who is listening in Pine Ridge, South Dakota on Keeley Radio. Hello, Kenneth. Welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
My question was kind of concerning ICE itself. The campaign before it started is to prep all of its staff to identify the identification documents that's going to be accepted. So in Indian country across America, if an ICE organization enters a state, a particular state, like South Dakota, we have several tribes. And each tribe here in the state of South Dakota has its own unique form of identification. Does the ICE organization prep itself and its staff that's going to be working in that state to know what those documents look like?
Mm-hmm. Kenneth, that's a really good question. I'm going to go ahead and let Danny Christney respond. And Danny, of course, I'm sure you know as well as all of us, many different tribes, many different types of ID. How well acquainted is ICE with these various tribal IDs? And do you recommend people still maintain a state-issued ID in addition to a tribal ID just in case?
Yeah, to answer the second part of the question first, I think you can't have too many IDs right now with everything going on. And to answer about whether they've been trained, it's going to come down to the individual officer, right? As they're bringing in Department of Homeland Security employees from other areas to kind of fill the niches in ICE and to kind of expand removal operations, there's going to be, you know, varying degrees of training. In theory, they should be able to recognize what tribal government issued IDs are common in a state. But like we've seen in a couple isolated incidents here in Arizona, that's not always the case. And sometimes people, again, don't have access to their ID because they lost it, or they don't have access to their birth certificate, or they have like a delayed birth certificate here in Arizona, for example. And what happens is that person is taken into custody while they try to figure out this puzzle of can we confirm whether this person is a U.S. citizen or not. So even if ultimately this person will not be held in long-term detention, it can be very traumatic, even the few hours they're going through this kind of ordeal. And again, you cannot have too much identification. And okay, now really is the time to kind of get those things in order, as opposed to when you're in custody and you're calling a family member to, hey, can you come bring my birth certificate down to the ICE office or something like that.
Thank you, Danny. And Dr. Martinez, I want to go back to you because I think one of the challenges here and why this issue is so complex is because there is one way of looking at immigration in terms of policy and then also as a humanitarian issue. And do you see any conflicts between handling immigration with regard to both of those priorities?
No, not at all. I mean, when you consider the reasons why people leave their homeland in the first place, especially in the case of indigenous people, you know, you don't give up that relation easily. And so if you're far away from home, there's typically a compelling reason for having to take that risk, you know, in going to a foreign country in order to try to save yourself or save your family or save your nation. And I think that when you take the reasons, the human everyday reasons why people, you know, risk their lives like that to immigrate, it's not a casual decision. We're not talking about going on vacation. You know, then when it comes to any community that is suffering extreme duress, such as being an immigrant, maybe even being a refugee, you know, then it seems like the only sensible response, and tribal nations need to be aware of this as well. You know, don't get too preoccupied with the federal government all the time. The only sensible reaction to the situation is humanitarian. You know, and so in the case of indigenous people, I would say that one thing tribal nations can do, should be advocating, is to meet the special needs of indigenous immigrants. You know, they're far from home. They're away from people who speak their language. You know, they're far away from where their medicine is strong. And so they need their, indigenous immigrants need their community supported as well. Because Native people, you know, have had to endure forced immigration in our history. The most notorious example is the Indian Removal Act in the 1830s and all those tribes that got forced out of their homeland. You know, then more recently, a lot of us are descendants of the Indian Relocation Act, where a lot of our family and our ancestors were forced into urban areas far from home because the federal government wanted to deplete reservations of tribal citizens. And so we have some sense, you know, what the consequences are of immigration. And this is something that is beholden to all Native people to remember. We may not have much power when it comes to setting federal policy, but we have all kinds of power when it comes to setting tribal policy, which can be more humane and a whole lot less defensive.
All right. Really appreciate you, Dr. David Martinez, along with our other guests, Danny, Krishni, and Nola and Juanita, for joining our conversation here today on the show. And please don't forget to tune in again tomorrow when we will mark the 30th anniversary of Native America Calling's first live national broadcast. Until then, I'm Sean Spruce. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Good day. Guys, don't wait until you have symptoms. Regular checkups may catch health issues early, and conditions like diabetes, heart disease, liver disease, and prostate cancer are more treatable when caught early. Ask your Indian healthcare provider what health checks are recommended for your age and lifestyle. A message from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services.
Challenges to societal harmony abound. Trauma, depression, addiction. In Native communities, these challenges affect nearly everyone. The Native American Social Work Studies Institute educates social workers for careers to address the needs of Native communities. You can be part of the solution as a peer support worker, community health worker, or a counselor with culturally relevant training from the Native American Social Work Studies Institute. Info at online.nmhu.edu. New Mexico Highlands University supports this show.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.